Just a note before we start. Our show talks about touchy subjects that may be difficult for some of our listeners. Take care of yourself. If you feel you need to seek help, see the links at the end of our show notes for resources.
Welcome to Touchy Subjects, the podcast that aims to make those awkward conversations around domestic and sexual violence just a little less awkward. I'm Sean.
I'm Allie.
And I'm Amanda.
And today we're joined with special guest, Raina Margetton. So thanks for joining us today, Raina.
Thanks so much for having me.
So just really quickly, would you be able to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. So I'm an attorney. I practiced law for many years, both in criminal defense and later as a volunteer working with domestic violence victims. I don't really like the word victims, people dealing with domestic violence. And when I left the practice of law, I also started writing, and I've been writing novels, and I'm about to have my third novel published.
All right. Yeah. And that's kind of what's brought you here to us, that intersection of both your law experience and your work with domestic violence survivors, and also a little bit of your writing, right? And so what, after you, left your law practice, what kind of inspired you to begin writing fiction?
So I actually had no idea what I was going to do with myself. My children were mostly kind of out of the house by that point, and I was kind of looking at a little bit of an open vista. I was luckily not in dire need of getting a paying job right away. So I was able to kind of explore things that I might be interested in. And I had a friend who was taking a writing class at a local college, and she told me to come with her. And at first I said no, it sounded crazy to me. It was a memoir writing class. And I said, I'm not writing memoir. Memoir is like Michelle Obama or, whatever, people with like remarkable lives. And, I'm happy with my life, but I don't have things like that to talk about. But I pretty quickly figured out that memoir isn't necessarily about the huge life trajectory. It's really more about moments in your life and ways that you can try to write in a way that other people can relate to the emotions and the personalities that were important to you. So I started doing that, and it just kind of took off from there.
And in listening to you just kind of talk about, especially at the memoir class, how looking at it, because I view memoirs in pretty much the same way as like, oh, someone who has like this super amazing life, so they can tell like all of these awesome stories that people want to hear. But looking at it from a frame of, it's telling specific stories to allow for you to not only express whatever experience you have, but for other people to look at and connect to that story, in a sense, really just, it's writing like any other thing. Like when you're writing fiction, like you're still using real emotions, you're still using those real experiences. So it's really interesting listening to that and realizing like, oh yeah, I could write a memoir, even though I'm not like super awesome or famous, but someone might like it.
That's right. Well, first of all, I'm sure you are super awesome, but I think, the point that I'm also making is that these small moments are, they're universal, and you can write about your relationship. I wrote quite a bit about my mother when I took the class, because she had passed away not too long before I signed up for the class. And, when you're writing about that relationship, a daughter and a mother, that's a universal for, half the population. And, and it was really meaningful to me. And when you write from the heart and you really try to get things out there, other people can relate to you. And that's really what you're trying to do with memoir.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons I like I like media a lot, obviously. Like, I'm literally wearing a Camp Crystal Lake t-shirt while doing this recording. But just the way that you can tell stories to make people connect or have that connection amongst themselves, even if their backgrounds are so different, is one of the things I love so much about media, is because all of us are different people, but when we watch something, there's something in that we can connect to, so we can still have conversations about it and start seeing each other not as different, but people who have similar or shared experiences.
For sure. And, definitely I found in memoir class that people write a lot about loss, right? Like, you don't end up going to memoir class and writing about the greatest day in your life or things that you're super happy about. Like often you're writing about, you know, the loss of loved ones or loss of identity or loss of a job or, you know, and at the time when I went, I had pretty much, you know, lost a lot of stuff and people that were important to me. And, you know, it's really powerful to learn how to write about that in a way that other people will connect, even if it's not their particular loss, right? You're not writing about their loss, but you're writing about your own. But you know, everybody has those universal emotions, and they want to see them expressed, and they want to feel that they have camaraderie with the author, between the author and the writer.
Yeah, you know, writing memoirs is a version of storytelling, and storytelling has been around since the dawn of time, right? And storytelling can be such an impactful medium to make social change and to experience the world from others' points of views, and to create that empathy that, especially in our field, we seek to create in our communities. We want an understanding of things. Sure. And so I think that, you know, while it may have felt like, well, why would I go to a writing class? It very much connects to the work that you had been doing, right?
Well, definitely. And actually, one of the reasons I got into it was that, you know, when I was working as a criminal defense attorney, I was doing appellate work. So these people had already, you know, been convicted of the crime, and they were seeking another chance. And, you know, oftentimes it was just a straight legal issue. Something had gone wrong with their trial. But many times it was really an attempt to tell their story in a way that would somehow lead to some redeeming qualities in these people coming through. And I'm not telling you that they all had redeeming qualities. Some of them didn't, but you know, a lot of them did. And a lot of them had a more complicated and more nuanced past than just the crime that they had committed. And, you know, so that was kind of our whole training in the appellate division that we were doing, was that, you know, how do you get that across? How do you tell the story, you know, in a way that maybe they won't get a second chance, but maybe they will. And, you know, I kind of, by the end of my job, I kind of had gotten to the point where I was finding that difficult to do, because when you do it, you know, I did it for almost 20 years, and it's hard. I mean, a lot of these people have done really terrible things, and, you know, it just got difficult for me. And I began to be really aware of how little I knew about the actual bigger picture of these defendants. Like, I knew a lot about the crime they had committed, and I knew, you know, a little bit about what happened immediately before and a little bit about what happened immediately after, but I didn't know anything really about their family or their, you know, what was their schooling like, or did they have a teacher that they admired? Did they have a first love? Did they, you know, I just didn't know anything. And it really inspired me to kind of, when I moved to fiction, it allowed me to fill in all these gaps that, you know, I know that's not truth. I know I'm not writing a biography of these people, but, you know, it allowed me to create something that I found satisfying. It allowed me to understand these people better, even if it wasn't, you know, even if it was in my imagination. And that, you know, I think that can be very powerful. That's one of the ways fiction can be so powerful, is that it allows you to see things that, you know, they're not true exactly, but they're not true either. And, you know, that's really what I found amazing about switching to writing fiction.
Right. You're allowed at that point to make them a person. You know, they're more than just this crime that they've committed, and you're allowed to give them that backstory and, you know, those personality traits and, like you said, just those redeeming qualities that maybe some people have and maybe some don't, but there are people out there who definitely don't get to see that.
Right. And it allows you to kind of think what else could be there, right? Like, you know, like my first book was based on a sexual assault case that I handled on appeal, and it had a very clear-cut legal issue that went in the defendant's favor. I did win him a new trial, but it also had very clear-cut facts that he was guilty, right? And in real life, you know, I was okay representing him that way, because that was my job. You're a public defender. You represent whoever you're assigned to. And I did the best job I could. And the best job actually got him a new trial. And then he was found guilty again. I mean, it's not, he was going to be found guilty. He was guilty. But in the book, I based the story on it. And I opened it up. I said, what if it wasn't that clear that he was guilty? What if there were issues here of consent? What if there were issues of alcohol and drug use during the encounter? What if there were issues of, maybe he had a past where he did things like this, or maybe his past relationships were consensual, and that's why we're not seeing the whole history in this. And I'll be frank with you, I'm sure there were people that didn't react well to it. I mean, most people, I think, got it, and most people, I think, we're happy to read something and say, the world is a complicated place. And especially with, intimate partner domestic violence, where the people know each other and they're part of, maybe even part of a family, there's a lot of story there. It's not all completely black and white. But I'm sure, for other people, it just triggered, bad feelings and bad memories. And they probably just felt like, we don't want to explore things like this. So, it's definitely, you take your chances when you try to write stuff like this.
But. Yeah. And I've said it before on our podcast, and I've said it multiple times in presentations and stuff too, is that we need to have stories, whether they're fictional or based on real events, that portray sexual assaults, that portray domestic violence, but they need to be done in a nuanced way where the person telling that story understands not only the trauma that victim is going to experience, but also can kind of help show what that process might look like. So, like, for example, using your book, Raina, you're giving that reader, even though maybe not intended, you're giving your reader an inside view to what could possibly happen if they were to ever report a sexual assault, or if they were to ever have sexual assault reported against them. They have now at least some kind of idea or understanding of what that process is going to look like, so it's not that foreign to them, which can be a great tool for victims of domestic and sexual violence, because now it's not this big scary thing. It's still going to be scary for sure, but at least now there's a little bit of an understanding, so they're at least somewhat familiar with what might happen.
Right. And the novel goes through, really, I don't want to say in detail, but it goes through the court process. So if one were ever to, take the witness stand or, whatever, you'd have a sense. What is it going to be like? What are they going to ask me? What, how am I going to look on cross-examination? What does that look like? So.
Yeah. I also think that with fiction, and we talked a little bit about this with our guest, Jamie, as well, the power of understanding the dynamics of domestic and sexual violence while writing fiction is so powerful. And I don't think that the impact of that can be measured, right? Because many times in fiction worlds, it's literally that, a fiction world. But when Right. you are taking real life things and you are implanting it into your fictional story, it creates kind of this understanding for people who may not seek out information on domestic and sexual violence in a very right. nonfiction sort of way, right?
Right.
But the other thing that doing, how you outlined that, you said you cast doubts, right? Like you were looking at that case thinking, what about these legal things, right? You were showing this person as a real human. And that's also something that I think conversation around domestic and sexual violence has a tendency to be in danger of ignoring. Mm-hmm. We often talk about victims. We should be talking about victims and survivors. We absolutely should. But when we talk about those who perpetrate abuse, we tend to villainize them. We tend to, or vilify them, rather. But they are also not one-dimensional
right.
people. Right? Right. They have entire stories. They have entire lives. And the choice to commit abuse doesn't happen in a vacuum. And so even though you said maybe some people wouldn't be so pleased to read how you had portrayed that, on the other hand, it shows the reality. It shows the reality that these are real humans that have real human qualities. They've made mistakes, they've committed crimes, or maybe they haven't, right? It depends on the case, but it doesn't happen in a vacuum. And that also leads to that idea of when people ask abuse victims, why didn't you just leave? Or why didn't you just go to the police? It's because these are complicated issues,
of course,
with nuances left and right and up and down. And so portraying that as a mirrored reality, I think is just really crucial.
Well, I think, you know, also when I got involved in doing volunteer work, I volunteer at a law school clinic that gets restraining orders for domestic violence survivors. And, you know, I was amazed. I mean, obviously I knew the stories were going to be complicated, but, you know, we in the clinic, we only represent the people, it's mostly women. We represent the women on their first court appearance. So we get them the initial restraining order, and then they come back and we have their case transferred to another organization that does the rest of the legal work for them. So even there, you know, we're getting a snapshot. You know, I may sit with a woman for an hour or 2 hours. I'm still not getting all the information I would get if I were actually representing her through to the final order of protection. But I was just amazed at the depth of the complexity, to be honest. Like, I just hadn't really thought through so well the issues of, you know, there were immigration issues. There were many, many issues surrounding the children. You know, there were issues surrounding the rest of the family. There were issues surrounding housing. How is she going to pay rent once we throw this guy out? How is she going to, you know, deal with childcare? I mean, there were so many issues and things that would at first appear so clear. You know, of course you want to ask for this guy to get vacated from your home. You know, you would talk for an hour and maybe it wasn't so clear. And maybe there were also, you know, they taught us right away, you know, you need to listen very carefully to what the woman is saying to you, because if she's saying to you, I am more afraid to do X than to not do it, well, that's something, you know, you can't push it. You can't say, like, you need to follow through with this because I see how dangerous this is. Well, she knows better. She knows the abuser and you don't. So, you know, I think it is all incredibly complicated, and especially when you're trying in some ways to be a little bit of a band-aid, like you're not, you know, you're not fixing her whole life for her. You're not addressing all, you know, you can refer her to other social services agencies that hopefully will help with some of these other complicated issues. But, you know, you're going into court and getting this TRO, that's great, but it's, you know, it's limited in its scope of what you're going to be able to help with. And, you know, that came out, like, my last novel, my latest novel, which is coming out shortly, is about a family court judge. And, you know, what I liked about it was that I was able to kind of incorporate a lot of what I had seen working in family court, both now as a volunteer and at the beginning of my career. And, you know, just to show that there are so many players involved, right? Like, it's not just the person complaining and the respondent. There's, you know, there's the judge, there's the clerks, there's the court officers, there's the caseworkers, there, you know, there's volunteers, there's people working with other agencies, and they all play a role, and they're not all going to get it right all the time. Like, sometimes they're just going to get it wrong, and that can have, you know, terrible consequences, but it's not as though they're not trying, but you know, everybody has to have some, you know, I don't know, some gratitude for the help that they're getting, but also, you know, understanding that, you know, no one is really seeing the whole picture here. And, yeah, you know, and it's hard. It's hard to know what to do when you don't have the whole picture.
Yeah. It seems like with not only situations of, like, sexual assault and domestic violence, but when any crime is committed, because of the way that our society is built on and these stereotypes that we have, when we think of these crimes, be it robbery, be it murder, be it sexual assault, we have a very vivid picture in our head immediately when we hear those terms of what that perpetrator and what that victim are going to look like. And when we stereotype crimes in that way, we make them very one-dimensional. So we're seeing this, okay, for example, like, I see a robbery. So in my head, I have my perpetrator and my victim in that situation. That's all I'm seeing now. I'm taking out every other piece of information that could come into play that, for one, may have led that person to becoming a robber in order to try to steal money for whatever situation they might have going on. So I'm only seeing them as a criminal, not somebody who's just really struggling through and needs to do something in order to protect, to get themselves food or something like that.
Right.
But I'm also seeing that perpetrator then as somebody who is just a victim. I'm not seeing that person for any other situation, just the fact that they have been victimized now in this situation. If we were to really start creating some kind of change, it's reducing those stereotypes, because then we're taking into the full account or that full picture. And again, not to try to make justifications for people who have committed crimes and stuff, because obviously committing a crime is bad. We can all agree on that because we have laws that tell us to do it. But I can also make justifications for why somebody might commit robbery or resort to violent crimes based on their life experiences. And by just saying like, oh, they're a criminal, but not focusing on those life experiences, we lose the ability to rehabilitate criminals.
I think also, you know, turning back time a little bit to the extent that we can, so that we see what the person was going through when they were younger, I think, you know, I think can have a tremendous effect on how we view what they've done. Not that it exonerates anybody or justifies what they've done, but, you know, I wrote a middle grade book, and it's about a girl who has undiagnosed dyslexia. And dyslexia is like amazingly prevalent, first of all, in the general population. It's something like 20 to 25% of the population, but it's also amongst the jail population, the incarcerated population, huge. Because, you know, just imagine if you couldn't read. I mean, how would you function in society? And what would your life look like if you had terrible difficulty reading? And in the book, she kind of, the main character kind of has a cry for help moment where she does something that would otherwise be considered juvenile delinquency. She sets a fire, and, you know, luckily the people around her are able to see it for what it is, and able to see that, you know, she wasn't trying to hurt anyone. She wasn't even trying to damage the property. She was setting fire to her papers, her graded papers in her locker, because her mother was coming for parent teacher conferences. And she was just so ashamed of how her mother was going to view her again as a failure in school. And it's a small example, but you can see how, you know, when you're younger, you make stupid decisions, your brain is not fully formed, you don't know what you're doing. But when you get to that level of frustration and hopelessness, you can do all sorts of things. And, you know, and that could send somebody on a path, you know, luckily she, in the book, she kind of gets saved. It's a hopeful ending. But, you know, you could see where 10 years down the line, if she hadn't been, you know, rehabilitated in that way, you know, she could be a perpetrator, or she could be a victim. But it, you know, it really does something to your self-esteem and your, you know, the way you perceive yourself. So, you know, I think sometimes it's not like, you know, we can, you know, interview every defendant and get back to their childhood. We're not trying to be, you know, we're not putting them into psychoanalysis here, but, you know, looking to see where people have come from and what they've been growing up with and their circumstances, I think is critical.
And I think with something else that you said earlier, too, about how, you know, things went wrong in that person's trial and you got them a new trial. And yes, that person was still guilty. They were still found guilty. It doesn't change the fact. But no matter what, as humans, we're all allowed that fair trial. And, you know, people might just pass things up because they're like, ah, it's just obvious that he's guilty, whatever, but you know, you should still have that fair chance, just like anybody else would.
Right. No, that's kind of the cornerstone of criminal appellate law, is that, you know, you're looking for things, and people think, oh, you're looking for technicalities and you're just trying to get the person off, and that's not really what you're doing. I mean, you are picking through it and you're getting into the nitty-gritty, but it's so that you're ensuring, you know, trying to ensure that they had a fair trial. So
yeah, because I can only imagine that somebody who has been victimized in a way around sexual assault, domestic violence, and then their perpetrator gets off or ends up getting out of prison because they appeal and say, like, I didn't have a fair trial, and then they just get out of jail because their trial wasn't fair. So now that person's just back out.
But it really doesn't work that way, because if they didn't have a fair trial, if that was what you were basing your appeal on, the remedy is to get a new trial. So they wouldn't actually be like out and about. They'd be out and about if for some reason the case wasn't proven against them beyond a reasonable doubt. But, you know, if that is what the judge finds, then you know what? They deserve to be out, right? I mean, the case does have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah. And thank you for the clarification too, because I think that also helps people who are listening and like have that fear of like, well, what happens if they don't get a fair, like if it says they don't get a fair trial, like I don't want that person just getting out because of it. So it is helpful for people listening to know that like, there will be a process to continue on. They're not just getting out of jail.
No.
And one of the things I do want to point out too is we had mentioned how like we villainize people who commit crimes and everything too, which is in part a little funny to me just on the general consensus on how we tend to view villains in our society. So like, for example, we love a good villain. Every story loves a good villain, and your story is only as good as the villain is. Yet in a general consensus, when we see somebody committing crimes in real life, we're like, that is just a bad person. It doesn't matter how charismatic they are. It doesn't matter how good looking they are. Like, they are a bad person. But when it comes to things we're watching, we love seeing Loki do stuff, even though we know he's a villain, but we can make the justifications for Loki because we know his backstory or we know his childhood. Where with just people in our lives, when they commit crimes, we're like, they're still a bad person though.
Well, maybe that's just the distinction between reality and fiction, right? Like, like in my book, the bad guy, you know, whether you think he's bad or not, he is charming and he is kind of a sociopath and he is good looking and all those things. And, you know, I did present him that way because I wanted people to invest in him. He's a good, you know, he's a good villain, right? But, but you're right. But, you know, if it were in real life, I'm not sure how people would feel about him. I think that they would see him, you know, probably for what he is. So.
Yeah. And like because I think the thing we like a lot about villains is we like good redemption stories, is we like being able to see somebody go from being that villain or that bad person to being somebody who can be good, or at least kind of who can do good. Because we have this general viewpoint of, yes, we're going to be able to rehabilitate somebody who has done wrong, so now they're a good person or at least a benefit to society. Like using Loki again, like he goes out a hero, or at least he goes out a good person. Yet when we have those real life examples, so again, I'm really nerdy, so this might not resonate with any of you, but the guy who played Elongated Man in the TV series The Flash, 10 years ago, he made tweets that were sexist and racist, and he was fired from his job. Yet his whole character arc in that TV series was about how he went from this dirty cop to being a really good private eye and a contributor to society. So we love his story in the show about him having that redemption arc. Yet we don't allow necessarily for that forgiveness often for when people commit problems or cause harm in their past, which I think makes it really difficult then for people who have done harm to feel like they can move forward or be beneficiaries to society, or at least not be viewed as a criminal.
Or at least reintegrate into society, because most people, unless they've done something truly, you know, dastardly, are going to get out of, you know, prison at some point in their lifetime. And, you know, even somebody that gets out, you know, gets a 20 to 25 year, you know, sentence, you know, even they are eventually, unless they're very old to begin with, are going to get out. So you do want to have that. I agree with you. I mean, you want to leave room for people to change and to, you know, reintegrate. And it's hard.
It is. I just think this whole conversation really underlines that need for empathy building and the need for a whole human approach to the work that we do. But not only the work that we do, but our day-to-day lives when we're walking around and showing kindness to people when maybe we automatically don't want to show kindness to them. The person that cuts us off, or the person that, you know, rushes past you on a busy street or something like that. Just having that empathy and kindness and thinking, well, is it harming me? Is it harming me directly? Could there be a reason that they're acting this way? I just think is really important.
I think also, if I could just jump in for a second, that's actually one of the reasons that I picked dyslexia as the you know, issue that, or the challenge that the girl in my book was dealing with, because, you know, it's not something really obvious. It's not something that you can see from the outside. And, you know, she was getting bullied. She was, you know, feeling bad. And, you know, you just don't know what people are dealing with, right? You don't know. You look at somebody, you don't know if they're having financial problems at home. You don't know if they have a chronically ill parent. You don't know if they are dealing with mental health issues. You know, there are things that you can look at somebody and know right away, I should be kind, I should be empathetic. You know, a person is, you know, in a wheelchair, a person is very old, whatever. You know, some things you can look at and say, I'm being called upon to be empathetic and compassionate. But other things you can't see. And so to me, the answer is don't wait to learn that that person needs help. How about just being a decent person all the time? And it's not, you know, that's not always easy. And it's not, you know, you don't always have to do the huge gesture, but the small gesture, you know, why not? Why wouldn't you do that? You know, you don't know why the person cut you off. You don't know where they're going and what was on their mind that they didn't see you when, you know. So, you know, to me, that's a really important point that you made.
Yeah, I think that this has been a really great conversation, and I really thank you for coming on here and talking about this kind of piece of our world that I is kind of unexplored sometimes, right? How our reality mirrors the fictional worlds that we immerse ourselves in, and kind of what responsibility we have to make those fictional worlds be both accurate, but also take something away from them, right? So I want to be able to give you time. Do you have this new book that's coming out? Can you tell our listeners all about that?
Thanks. So yes, the new book is actually available for pre-order now. It's being released in October. It is the story of a family court judge who is trying very hard to kind of exert her own control and her own thoughts over the many troubled families that come before her. And in the course of it, she kind of loses sight of the fact that her own personal life is kind of imploding. So it's told in alternate points of view between the judge and the man that she had been living with. And, you know, it's got a lot of good family court material in there, you know, that your listeners might be interested in. I mean, she does, you know, one of the real turning points in the book is when a woman comes in for a restraining order, and the judge, she just miscalculates on the lethality of the situation, and she denies the vacate order because in her head she doesn't want this woman to lose out on the relationship that she has, and she's doing it from a personal point of view, because you know what, that comes in also. Like, you can try your best to be totally objective and you're trying so hard to just be fair and deal with the facts, but you're a human being, and if your boyfriend has just left you and this woman comes into court asking for a restraining order and to vacate her husband from the house, you know, maybe you're not listening with the right ears. And, you know, so just a lot of stuff goes on in the book where she's kind of learning how to be a better person and learning how to love. And yeah, so that's the new book.
Yeah. And we will make sure that the link to your pre-order is going to be in our show notes. So if anyone listening wants to check out that book, you can find the link to that in our show notes as well. Raina, do you have any socials that you want to plug for our listeners?
You know, I'm on everything. I mean, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram, what else am I on? LinkedIn and Twitter. I'm on them all. I mean, I'm not tremendously active because I'm kind of old. So I don't really, you know about stuff like that so much, but I'm doing my best. So yeah, if you do any combination of Raina, Martyr, Genton, you'll find me.
Awesome. And I'll make sure I post links to your socials in our show notes as well. So thank you for joining us today, Raina. It was a wonderful discussion. Anytime I can talk about media, I'm going to enjoy it. So thank you for being here. And also thank you for providing our listeners with a perspective that we are not often privy to, or at least don't provide very often. So thank you for that.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you all for listening today. Please feel free to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at TouchySubsPod. Please feel free to email any questions, comments, or concerns to touchysubjectspodcast@gmail.com.
And in the meantime, don't be afraid to challenge, ask, and discuss when it comes to touchy subjects.